From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Tensions between the U.S. and Iran are playing out today in Iraq. An angry mob protesting U.S. airstrikes in Iraq and Syria that killed Iranian-backed Iraqi militiamen smashed through the front entrance of the American embassy in Baghdad. Driving what looked like a large piece of wood into the door there, the crowd then set fire to a reception area. U.S. Marines fired tear gas to hold them back, and the State Department says there was no breach of the embassy. U.S. personnel are secure. But still, the images are throat-catching and the politics complicated. The protests followed the funerals of some of those Iraqis killed in the U.S. airstrikes, which the Pentagon said targeted a militia backed by Iran, and blamed the U.S. for the death of an American contractor in Iraq. In a tweet today, President Trump said Iran orchestrated today's U.S. embassy protest. Barbara Slavin is director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. And Barbara, we're told by a reporter we spoke with on the ground in Baghdad that Iraqi security forces let those protesters over the bridge to the U.S. embassy. And again, these were Iraqis who were killed in a U.S. strike, even though the U.S. says they're Iranian-backed. How complicated is this?
It's very complicated. It's very ominous. It is one of the consequences of the U.S. decision to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal and to try to prevent Iran from exporting oil. Iran is retaliating in a variety of ways. We've seen attacks in the Persian Gulf. We've seen Iran begin to breach limits in that nuclear deal. And we've also seen Iran use its proxies in places like Iraq to, send rockets against the green zone where the American embassy is, various bases where American troops are based, and now, of course, an American contractor has killed, and the U.S. has retaliated, and now Iran-backed groups are retaliating. But what it also shows is the untenable position that U.S. policy toward Iran has put Iraq in. Iraq is not in a position to antagonize its neighbor. And, the U.S. is really demanding something from Iraq that it's not capable of providing at this time.
Well, and Iraq already had a fragile, at least, during the time when there was the Iraq War, a fragile divide between the Sunnis in Iraq. It's a Sunni-led government and the
Shia-led government.
Yeah, it's a Shia-led government. Sorry.
It's a Shia-led government that the U.S. and Iran jointly installed.
Right. And before that, it was a Sunni government and the Iranians were Shia. And so they had this split in the country between the Shia and the Sunni. And now, you have Iran backing these militias. So there's a lot of cross currents here. When you say that this starts with President Trump pulling out of the nuclear deal, I mean, how so? I mean, how did that tumble to this place?
Yeah. Well, look, Iran was complying with this deal. It did not touch on regional issues. It touched on the nuclear issue. The U.S. decided somehow would have more leverage against Iran if it pulled out and imposed what it called a maximum pressure campaign. But Iran has retaliated and in ways that the U.S. doesn't appear ready to deal with. Excuse me. It's, U.S. policy, it's like we don't see around the corners anymore. And it's really shocking that the United States would put its diplomats in this kind of jeopardy. Understanding that Iran had this capability, that the Iraqi government would not really be able to protect Americans. These are very powerful militias. The one in particular that the U.S. struck is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Iranian Quds Force, which is part of the Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and obviously has sympathizers within the security forces in Iraq that let them to the embassy.
Barbara, I have to ask, this was part of the reason that the Trump administration pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, because it felt that Iran was backing groups like Hezbollah, groups that the U.S. considers terrorists. But as you say,
it's all backfired.
Right.
It's all backfired.
It's all backfired.
Everything has gotten worse since the U.S. left the deal. We didn't have incidents in the Persian Gulf. Iran was in compliance with its nuclear obligations. It was powerful in Lebanon and in Iraq and Syria. It's still powerful in Lebanon, Iraq, and Syria. And what's even worse is that, the U.S., by retaliating as it did, killing perhaps 24 Iraqi citizens on Iraqi soil, has changed the narrative now. There were protests in Iraq against Iran. There were protests in Lebanon against Iran. Now the protests are against the United States.
Barbara Slavin, director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. And we also have to cross the T here. When the Trump administration pulled out of that nuclear deal, all inspectors said that Iran was abiding by the nuclear deal. Now, as we say, protesters at the U.S. Embassy. Barbara, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow morning on New Year's Day, thousands of laws will take effect across the United States, and many of the most significant ones will be here in California. The country's most populous state often leads the way for state houses across the country. This year, California is part of a larger nationwide effort to reform housing, criminal justice, and predatory lending. Joining us now is Scott Rodd, state government reporter for Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. And Scott, let's start with housing. California, of course, is notorious for having some of the highest rents in the country. A new law going into effect will cap the amount landlords can increase rent per year. Tell us more.
So advocates were calling for something closer to rent control, which would be more of a freeze on rents. But a compromise was struck where landlords, under this law, landlords can only raise rents by 5% plus inflation each year. It only applies to units that are older than 15 years old. So it still captures many apartments and rental units. But that 15-year-old part was important in order to get some landlords and developers on board. And it also is part of the rent cap law. There's also a part of it that protects people from unjust evictions. So landlords have to provide cause. And if they don't provide that cause, there's actually protections where if someone has to relocate, the landlord may be on the hook for paying for some of those moving costs.
Let's talk about another significant law taking effect, a payday loan rate cap. California's lending laws are considered lax compared to other states. Explain what this law means.
That's right. California is lagging. 38 other states have protections for people in place when they're getting payday loans. So this law caps interest rates for loans between $2,500 and $10,000 at 36%. And those are typically the types of loans that people take out when, you know, they have some sort of immediate crisis. If their car breaks down, if they have, an emergency room bill. So that's supposed to try to block lenders who are really preying on someone who may be in an urgent situation and capping that interest rate so they're not squeezing them for all they have.
Let's talk a little bit about criminal justice legislation. There's a new law that bans private for-profit prisons and immigrant detention centers here in California. It seems like this was a last-minute scrambling.
So you're right that there was this definite push this year to have it in place. The issue of, you know, prison population overcrowding in California has been around for a while. About a decade ago, a panel of federal judges said California prisons, state prisons are so overcrowded, it's basically cruel and unusual punishment. So they said, you guys got to reduce your prison population significantly in the coming years. So that's happened, but that's partly happened as a result of shifting some of those inmates to private prisons. And so supporters of the law say California's prison population is much more under control, so let's ease off of these private prisons. And then part of that, a big part of the conversation is also, you know, what does immigrant detention look like in these private prisons? So that's definitely a factor in the conversation. And so it's important to note that private prisons won't be banned starting January 1st. Private prisons just can't enter into new contracts to hold inmates. So if there are existing contracts, those can still essentially play out. But private prisons will be phased out by 2028. But there's been some news lately that private prisons have actually scrambled to enter into contracts before this January 1st deadline, and that's still caused a lot of controversy.
This next law is being described as one of the toughest standards in the nation for when law enforcement officers can kill. It governs police use of force. Tell us about this one.
So this law very much grew out of the shooting of Stephon Clark. He was a young, unarmed black man in Sacramento. It should say that there were other shootings as well that have factored into this, really sparked the call for this legislation. And the law sets a new standard for when officers are justified in using deadly force. So the previous standard is that an officer could use deadly force if they reasonably believed that their lives or the lives of a bystander was in danger. The new standard says an officer can only use deadly force when it's considered necessary.
Yeah, there's still lots of controversy about this. The ACLU has raised concerns that that definition you're talking about of necessary is still not set in stone.
So that's right. There are groups like the ACLU, which does still support the law, but has raised some concerns about, well, this definition of necessary ultimately is being left up to the courts and to prosecutors to define. But advocates and supporters of the law say that at least this will spur more training for de-escalation tactics and for police to better encounter individuals and avoid using deadly force.
Scott Rodd is state government reporter for Capital Public Radio. Scott, thank you and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Okay, you can admit it. It's just me and you here. How many of you sneak a peek at your daily horoscope? If you do, you're not alone. The mystical services market, another way of saying astrology and psychic readings, is a $2 billion a year business, and it's hugely popular among millennials. And while astrology is not scientifically proven, its widespread popularity cannot be denied. For more on this appeal, we're joined by Shani Nicholas, Oprah Magazine's resident astrologer and author of the new book, You Were Born for This, Astrology for Radical Self-Acceptance. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Shani, New York Magazine recently ran an article about astrology having a moment, and the subheadline said, in a demographic desperate for reassurance, a customized cosmos is a valuable proposition. Why do you think astrology is having such a moment right now, especially among millennials and Gen Zers?
I think that astrology is the perfect content for memes.
Yeah.
And so it gets
popular. Gets shared a lot.
Yeah,
yes.
It's very shareable. And human beings really want to know about ourselves. I want you to tell me something where I'm like, oh my God, that's so me. I relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have a meme with like all of the signs on it, let's say, then you can like tag all your friends and everyone can kind of be dragged and loved up a little bit.
Yes.
At the same time.
Yep.
And because we're living in such a social media saturated moment, I feel that astrology is like this perfect fit of self-reflection, humor, and identification.
I remember my mom was really into it and had the books when I was a little kid. But we're seeing that today now, and it's a little bit more than meme culture. I mean, that might be really pushing it along and we're seeing it more.
Yeah.
But there's a real sense that millennials and Gen Zers are holding on to astrology.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think, like, is your mom a baby boomer?
Yeah.
So I think the baby boomers came out of a time, they were part of a culture change that was really breaking away from this fake nuclear family facade and very, like, white supremacist and very classist and very, like, you fit into the mold. And the baby boomers came along and they were like, no, we need to break this whole thing open. And part of that was, of course, the Vietnam War and the revealing of government and what it was really about. And in that
during
iteration,
that time,
it was a
the Nixon era. There was a lot of stuff happening.
Yeah, and it was a huge kind of like crack in the psyche. Like, oh, we can't trust all the things that they've been telling us to trust. And maybe we knew that all along, but it's really a departure. And so astrology was huge back then. If we would have had the internet then, we would have been seeing, I think, the exact same thing.
Yeah.
But because we didn't have that kind of mass communication, you would have seen, though, a huge spike in the amount of books that were written out of that time.
Yeah.
And that got published in the decades after.
And tying that to today, I mean,
yeah.
They really do mirror each other.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
The baby boomers and the millennials and what we're dealing with today.
Yeah. And the okay boomer.
Yeah.
That's all part of it. It's like that now that millennials are, you know, like tearing away from the boomer generation. And so it's the next iteration of that. We're trying to evolve ourselves. We're trying to clarify our purpose and understand what are the biggest emergencies to tend to. And people really need to know, is there some reason for this?
And this is one way.
Systems like astrology can be like, well, this is the time frame and this is what's happening in this time frame. And this time frame happened also, you know, at this other cycle of life. Mm-hmm. And so if we can look back and see that time frame versus this time frame, we can kind of get a context for what's happening. And that can help to quell our panic and maybe move towards solution in the moment.
Speaking
That's
of,
my hope for it.
I mean, it sounds great. I mean, and it really, you brought up this idea of being able to connect different times. Mm-hmm. And to bring this all together, I read that until the 17th century, astrology was actually considered a scholarly tradition. So lots of folks studied it, along with medicine and other things.
Yeah, I really love that you brought that up. Thank you so much. It's like I'm always trying to tell people that I don't care if astrology is something that you like or believe in or think has any kind of weight to it. But the fact of the matter is that it was astrology and astronomy weren't separate.
Mm-hmm.
Medicine and astrology in a lot of places weren't separate. And so we were always in relationship with the sky. We were never not in relationship with the sky because we had to know what was the sun doing, what season was it.
Yeah.
When we were nomadic, we had to know how to travel.
Absolutely.
And we used the sky to guide us. Mm-hmm. So we were dependent on the sky and its movement. So it only makes sense that we would make meaning out of the planets that shifted as the sky shifted, as the season shifted. And we would be tracking that because maybe it was trying to tell us something.
Astrology is often referred to as pseudoscience. I'm curious what you think of that. Is it fair to call it that?
Astrology comes out of scientific roots, and because we are studying the movements of planetary bodies over time and coming up with facts about them, it's not to say that there's nothing scientific about astrology, but also, obviously, it's speaking a symbolic language, and so it's not necessarily quantifiable in the same way as which we would study other things, and then we have to get into the conversation of what is science and empirical knowledge, and what are we looking at, and what are our biases, and all of that stuff.
So
people can call it whatever they want.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how you got started. So in your book, you say the first time you encountered astrology was the first time you remember feeling seen. What do you mean by that?
Well, I grew up in a situation where I didn't really feel that acknowledged by the adults that were raising me or around. They were pretty preoccupied with a lot of different things. And the first time I went to an astrologer, I felt like it was the first time that someone slowed down enough to give me an accurate reflection of myself. And it was a stranger.
Mm.
And there was no reason why she should know the things that she did about me. But it was the first human being that took that much time and had that much precision and that much skill identifying the core parts of me.
Yeah.
And it was shocking and revelatory.
You describe the potential for astrology that it can foster radical self-acceptance. What does that mean?
I think radical self-acceptance is the ability to accept our hopes and dreams and desires and talents as they are so that we can work on perfecting them, making them better, getting more integrated with our skills so that we can apply them to the world and be of use in the best way possible. I've sat in front of so many people and read their chart and said, oh, wow, you really should do A, B, and C, or doing A, B, and C, does that interest you? And they'll be like, yeah, how do you know? And I never thought I could do that. Like, most people seem to have this buried desire that they feel they need permission to accept.
To be themselves.
Yes.
Yeah. You've been doing this for quite a while, but it's something that, based on reading your book, I've learned about you, that it's something that you're always practicing and perfecting and learning more about yourself even as you do the practice with other folks.
Mm.
Can you talk about that for a moment? Just this idea that we are always evolving as human beings and we're always in search of finding our true selves. And no matter how long we live, we're always going to be finding out things about ourselves.
Yeah, hopefully. I think that's what makes life worth living. And I think when you look at astrological cycles, you can see that, you know, there's certain planetary cycles that are like 12-year cycles, like Jupiter has a 12-year cycle, Saturn has a 30-year cycle. And I think seeing our lives in those cyclical patterns can be really helpful, because in the moment, in the minutia, we can sometimes feel like, wow, nothing ever changes. Yeah. I am in the same. You know, when our stuff comes up, we're like, I'm still dealing with this thing. Yeah. This is never changing. But if we can use astrology as a way to give us perspective and just like the time, you know, if we can just look back on our life and remember, oh, yeah, actually 7 years ago, I was really struggling with this. And now it's still hard, but I've actually made a ton of progress. And astrology will tell you where in your life to focus on making progress with that issue next. Hmm. And so it can be a nice, I think it's a really good friend.
A really good friend.
Yeah.
Astrology is a really good friend.
Yeah, I think it can be like, wow, you did really great in this like year cycle.
So as we're entering 2020, everyone's thinking about they're starting anew. This is my year. How would you recommend folks use astrology as they move through the year and build intention on what they want for the year?
I hope that people find themselves in it, and in the finding of themselves feel a little healed and motivated to just get on with life. Mm. Like to use those skills and those talents and those definitive marks that have been placed upon them, and just go forth with some confidence.
Chani Nicholas, Oprah Magazine's resident astrologer and author of the new book, You Were Born for This, Astrology for Radical Self-Acceptance. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. That was a joy.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here Now helps you make sense of the world, and when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
In Georgia, the saga over the purging of voter rolls continues. A federal judge ruled Friday that the state does not have to reinstate 98,000 voters removed from the rolls earlier this month, part of a larger purge of 300,000 people. A voting rights group has been challenging the purge in the courts. Emil Moffitt is a reporter at WABE in Atlanta. Welcome back, Emil.
Thank you very much, Tanya.
So, Emil, first remind us why Georgia conducted the voter roll purge in the first place.
Georgia maintains that this is their obligation under federal law to keep an accurate and up-to-date voting roll. Some of the voters, in fact, the majority of the voters who were removed from the voter rolls were because they had moved or they had passed away, something like that. But there were also a percentage, that percentage you mentioned, about 98,000, who had been taken off because they had not participated in the last two federal elections, or they had not had contact with the Secretary of State's office or with elections officials in several years. And so that was really what the crux of the argument was, whether those people should be taken off the rolls just for inactivity.
Now, I mentioned that this purge was challenged in court by a voting rights group. That group is the Fair Fight Action, which is founded by former Georgia Democratic gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams. What was the reason that the judge says he rejected the group's argument?
The group's argument was that this use-it-or-lose-it policy violated the First and 14th Amendments of the U.S. Constitution. And so he was being asked to see whether it put a severe burden on these voters to have to re-register or to have some sort of contact with elections officials. And the judge, Steve Jones, said that no, it did not impose a severe burden on these voters.
I'm guessing there are lots of efforts also underway for those voters who may not have any idea that they actually have been purged from the voter rolls. What do you know about that? How will they actually even know?
They won't know unless they go online to check their status or if somebody like one of these groups, voting rights groups, makes contact with these voters and say, hey, you might want to check your voting status because you might not be on the rolls anymore. The thing is, in Georgia, you have to register within 30 days of the election to be eligible to vote because Georgia does not have same-day registration. And that's one of the arguments from Fair Fight and other voting rights groups is that these voters might not know they're on the rolls. And if they show up on election day and they're not on the rolls, then they are out of luck.
So everyone, of course, is looking to the 2020 presidential election. This cancellation represents 4% of the state's 7 million registered voters. How could this purge impact Georgia's upcoming presidential primary in March and really the election?
It could be big. They're expecting large numbers as far as voter turnout coming up in the 2020 elections, not only the presidential primary in March, but also the general election in November. But 4% is not an insignificant number. And I think that's why you saw such a heated legal battle going down to the last minute, trying to keep as many voters on the rolls as possible. And I think what we saw last year in 2018, that Georgia is really shaping up to be a battleground state. And so I think that's why there's the attention on making sure that every single voter is given every opportunity to vote.
Emil Moffitt is a reporter at WABE in Atlanta. Emil, thank you so much for this update and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
Thomas Jefferson was the country's third president, the draftsman of the Declaration of Independence. But he also built buildings. Well, he didn't. Slaves did, carrying out his architectural designs. Which is why when the Chrysler Museum of Art in Norfolk, Virginia, created an exhibit of Jefferson's architecture, they joined a movement in museums to point out the history of slavery behind the artwork we see. The exhibit is called Thomas Jefferson, Architect, Palladian Models, Democratic Principles, and the Conflict of Ideals. And it features everything from a John Trumbull painting of the signing of the Declaration of Independence to the model of Jefferson's design for the so-called President's House competition. Eric Neal is the museum director there in Virginia. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for having me.
And I want you to talk right away about the reddish-brown brick. We'll have pictures at hearandnow.org, but this is a brick that's in the exhibit, and it seems to be almost a totem, maybe something for you as you curated and put this together with your team to kind of remind you of what it is you're doing here. What is that brick?
So, you know, Robin, we know a lot about Thomas Jefferson. There are hundreds, thousands of letters, documents with his name attached to them. We know he was a great architect. We also know, as you said, that all of the buildings that he was involved in were built by enslaved craftsmen. We know a couple of those names, but many of them we do not. And that brick really is a testament to all those people who built the buildings. And if you go to Monticello or the University of Virginia, literally you can see their fingerprints all over these buildings. They were enslaved workers, maybe skilled, maybe less skilled, but we know that they were the laborers who yeah. built these great buildings.
And as if to really drive that home, the brick has a handprint on it, you know, which is kind of the sweat of these workers. There's 120 objects in the exhibit. Give us some other examples of where you might have something that represents Jefferson as it might have 30 years ago before people thought to bring the history of the slavery into it and what you found from the input of enslaved laborers.
So, of course, we have great objects that relate to Thomas Jefferson. We have Trumbull, the signers of the Declaration of Independence, in which Jefferson figures prominently, and that Thomas Jefferson was involved in the design of this really iconic image. We have models of Jefferson's buildings. We have his drawings, the submission that he made for the President's House in Washington, what we now know as the White House. We have books from his own library with his notes in them. These are all objects that we would think about in any case in talking about Thomas Jefferson as an architect. What is new? Well, over the last, really, it's a generation of scholars. There have been studies of maybe we'd call the landscape of slavery. And what we've tried to do in this exhibition is not just have a sort of nameless mass of people, but where possible, bring into higher relief some of those craftsmen. And two that we were able to talk about particularly are John Hemmings and Isaac Granger, also known as Isaac Jefferson.
Okay, take John Hemmings because that's going to be a familiar name. His sister was Sally Hemmings. They spelt their names differently, but she was the mother of at least six of Jefferson's children. I mean, we're getting more and more familiar with the hypocrisy, really, of the time, you know, when Jefferson owned slaves and fathered children of a slave. John Hemmings was Sally Hemmings' brother. What did he do?
So technically, I believe he's her half-brother, but just to be specific, he was a very talented carpenter. And he worked at Monticello, and we have an object, a door that he built from Poplar Forest. Poplar Forest is another home that Jefferson had in Western Virginia, and sort of his retreat from Monticello, if you will. And that's being carefully restored, in really in a kind of like a CSI method, really looking at the tools and the materials that would have been of that era. And through their analysis, they've been able to determine that a door, which wouldn't have a signature, right? We wouldn't have, John Hemmings wouldn't sign a work of carpentry. And in fact, many of the records might not indicate exactly who was responsible for what. That because they were able to compare this door to his own tools, and those tools have survived, along with cross-referencing to the archival record, they're able to say with a great deal of certainty that this door was created by John Hemmings. And that tells the story in a more direct and immediate way.
And then you have Isaac Granger, also known as Isaac Jefferson, an enslaved metalsmith, later freed. I'm looking at the picture that you have in the exhibit. It's just beautiful. We'll post it at hereandnow.org. Describe it in this man.
So it really is a stunning image, and it's something that you could hold in your hand. It's a daguerreotype, so it's a very early photograph. It's from the 1840s. And Isaac Granger was trained as a metalsmith and even as a silversmith. He went up to Philadelphia, and he became really an expert in his craft. He was noted in Thomas Jefferson's time also for the skill and the speed with which he produced nails. And the nailery was one of the places at Monticello where Jefferson tried to bring in some income. And so Isaac Granger and many other young enslaved workers, boys really, would be employed there. And if they had skill, they might be able to stay. And those nails we find all over Monticello, and we have several of them in a case.
Yeah.
But talking about that photograph, what's really important there in the history of photography would be his own agency in the creation of that image. He's wearing his work shirt and his apron. He's looking directly at the camera.
Yeah.
He puts his massive hands really right up in the front of the image. These are, of course, they were the reason why he was so successful, his ability to work the metal. And there are many images we have of enslaved people, but often it's the photographer taking the image. And in this case, we have the sitter really deciding how he wants to be looked and be represented. And that's an important thing to note, especially in the history of photography, who gets to determine what the image is.
Right. Again, we'll have the pictures at hereandnow.org. But Eric Neal, again, the director of the Chrysler Museum of Art in Norfolk, Virginia. I just want to ask you about this movement that you are now a part of in recognizing the history of oppressed people that underpins, you know, the artwork we see in museums. I'm reading reporting on the Worcester Art Museum, terrific little museum in Massachusetts, where they decided, I mean, it was too expensive to, you know, mount completely new exhibits, but they went through all their exhibits and put little notes next to what they already had, indicating, you know, and by the way, someone else was responsible for bringing this artwork to you. A note, for instance, under a portrait of a captain notes that the compensation for his military duties included his living expenses and a slave named York. This idea, according to those curators, that, you know, many of the people who we see in museums were the wealthy because they could afford to have their paintings made. But those people got where they were on the backs of oppressed people. You know, obviously you incorporated this in your Jefferson exhibit, but is this something that you see museums thinking a lot about?
I do, and Worcester was really leading the way. It's a great collection, and other institutions. I know Harvard has followed the Worcester lead, and they said, "Hey, we need to tell a story of the people. We talk about the sitters and their wealth and their success, but where did that come from?" So it's really all of what we're doing is telling a fuller story a story that is often known to scholars and historians, but it hasn't been presented to the broader public on a regular basis as part of the regular story. Right. And I think that is the trend that you're seeing in museums across the country, and not just with African Americans or enslaved workers, but all sorts of groups that maybe hadn't been represented as fully.
Yeah, people who were oppressed in any way, including through violence. It's a richer experience, I would imagine. And by the way, some of the objects came from the University of Virginia. Jefferson designed the grounds of the school. Have you gotten response from students?
We haven't gotten specific response from students. We have, however, gotten response from alumni, and there are a lot of UVA alumni. I would say it's been almost entirely positive. Occasionally, I'll get a comment from someone who says, oh, why do you have to tarnish his image, or haven't we talked about this enough? Mm. And in any case, we want to tell as much of the history as accurately as possible, maybe bring out some stories of accomplishment in the face of tremendous odds, if you will.
Yeah. That's Eric Neal, director of the Chrysler Museum of Art in Norfolk, Virginia. We're talking about their exhibit and the thinking behind it. It's titled Thomas Jefferson, Architect, Palladian Models, Democratic Principles, and the Conflict of Ideals. It runs through January 19th. Eric, thank you.
My pleasure, Robin. I love your show.
Vladimir Putin became Russia's acting president 20 years ago today, and he's basically ruled the country ever since. The former KGB officer succeeded Boris Yeltsin after Yeltsin resigned on December 31st, 1999. Putin is Russia's longest-serving ruler since Joseph Stalin. The BBC's Steve Rosenberg joins us now from Moscow. And Steve, you've said that Putin ushered in a new era when he assumed power. How did he do that?
I think, in a sense, the first sign of this, not so long after he became president, actually, was he returned the old Soviet anthem, the old melody of the Soviet national anthem. That was a sign that in some ways Vladimir Putin was going to take Russia back to the past or try to revive the memories of Russia as a great superpower. But also his critics will say that he's attempted to dismantle democracy along the way. We've seen a whole raft of laws being passed by the Duma, what has become basically a puppet parliament in Russia, which clamps down on a freedom of assembly. So we've seen Russia going down a very different path. In the 1990s, although that was a chaotic decade, there was hope that Russia would become a Western European country, that Russia was once and for all dedicated to Western ideals of free speech and democracy. I think what we've seen after Vladimir Putin came to power is this country moving in a different direction. His supporters will say, well, Russia has become a stronger country for that, that under Vladimir Putin, Russia has risen from her knees, regained self-respect. But his critics will say that is at the expense of personal freedoms. And I think there is concern amongst liberal Democrats, whatever you call them, pro-Western figures here, that screws are being turned. And that as we move into the new year, the fate of Russian democracy, lies in the balance.
Is there a sense, can we even get a sense of his popularity then in the country if people are feeling that their civil liberties are being in any way threatened?
There was a poll done recently by quite a respected polling agency here, which found that 70% of Russians were generally approving of what Putin is doing in the country. Now, that doesn't mean that 70% of Russians love Vladimir Putin. Far from it. I think the Russian population divides into some Russians who love what he's doing, who love the fact that the country is going back to the past and becoming a global player again. Then there are other Russians who say, well, we just don't want anything to rock the boat. We don't want war. We don't want instability like there was in the 1990s. So let's have no change. Let Putin stay in power. We don't want change. We fear change. Mm. And then there are other people who say, well, we don't see any alternative to Vladimir Putin. We don't see anyone in this massive country, the biggest country in the world, a country of 145 million people, who could be a president instead of Vladimir Putin.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, the explanation for that is very simple, that over 20 years, Vladimir Putin has made sure that there are no opponents, there are no rivals. He has constructed a political system that revolves around him, and he has cleared the political landscape completely. So, you know, very often we travel around the country, we speak to young people who've basically only known Vladimir Putin. They had 4 years of President Medvedev, but still, Vladimir Putin was prime minister and basically running the shop. And so many young people say to me, we can't imagine Russia being run by anyone else.
My last question for you, here in the U.S., you know, there's lots of conversation about the relationship between Putin and our president, President Trump. They spoke on the telephone over the weekend. Trump's critics say he's really too cozy with Putin. And then there's the 2016 U.S. election, which Putin denies interfering with. Is this a topic of discussion in Russia? What is the sentiment there over this?
If you sit down at the dinner table with a Russian family, they are not going to be talking about Donald Trump or, to be honest, Vladimir Putin. You know, people are too busy getting on with their lives and struggling through. The economic situation is pretty tough here. But I think there's no doubt that when Vladimir Putin looks at what has been happening in the United States, he looks at the political chaos which was caused by Trump's arrival on the scene, when he looks at what's happening in Europe with Brexit and potential weakening of the European Union, when he looks at what's happening in NATO and all the bickering and arguments between NATO members and between Turkey, a NATO member, and the United States and other European NATO members, that would put a big smile on the face of Vladimir Putin, because there is a big feeling here that what Russia is pushing for is a weakening of Western institutions like NATO and the European Union, a weakening of America as the major global power. And if you look at things in those terms, 2019 was a pretty successful year for Vladimir Putin.
The BBC, Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. Steve, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now. The new year starts with the prospect of an impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate. President Trump just the third American president to be impeached. We'll speak with historian Douglas Brinkley about that and what may lie ahead in 2020, which, oh yes, is also an election year. Next time, Here and Now.